All right, Queens, welcome to another episode. I have a special guest with me today, and I'm going to read Anita's bio for you so you can get to know her a bit before she introduces herself. So I have with me today Anita Johnson, PhD. She is a clinical psychologist, certified eating disorder specialist, and author of Eating in the Light of the Moon, which has been published in seven languages. She is the co-creator of the Light of the Moon Cafe, an online resource with interactive and self-study courses for women all around the world. A pioneer in the field of eating psychology for over 35 years, she is currently the founder and executive clinical director of iPono Hawaii Eating Disorder Programs, which has a residential eating disorder treatment program on Maui in Hawaii. So Dr. Johnson provides virtual individual consultations and conducts workshops internationally. She is best known for integrating metaphor and storytelling into her training as a clinical psychologist to explain the complex issues that underlie struggles with eating and body image. So without further ado, Anita, welcome, such a big welcome to the Body Love Binge podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What we're going to do, we're going to dive straight in with 10 quick fire questions, which are a bit fun so we can just get to know each other a bit better. So, you ready for
Great.
that?
Ready.
Okay. So, number one, if you could swap lives with any fictional character for a day, who would it be and why?
Wow, who would it be? Actually, it's a character from a fairy tale I grew up with called Serena, and she was a mermaid.
Oh, nice. I've not heard of that one. Serena. Okay, number two, what's the weirdest food combination you secretly love if you have a weird combination you like?
Oh, what would that be that's weird? Can't think of anything. And maybe because it might be weird to somebody else, but it just seems perfectly normal to me.
Love that. Number three, if you had to listen to one song on repeat for the rest of your life, what would that song be?
It would be Stand By Me.
Oh, I love that. I play that in my retreats and we sing it to our younger selves and higher selves. Love that. Okay, next one. What's the most spontaneous thing you've ever done and did it turn out well?
Well, yes, the most spontaneous thing I did is when I was a lot younger, I decided to I'm from the island of Guam, and I decided to leave Guam and go to school in Boulder, Colorado, and it was the best thing I could have done.
Wow, that's awesome. Bold and brave, following your heart.
Yes, I'd never seen mountains, buses, freeways, snow, any of that, and I just said, I'm going there.
And off you went.
Off I went.
So cool. A woman after my own heart, I believe. Okay, next one. If you could be an if oh sorry, let me rephrase. If you could have any animal as a pet and it would be magically perfectly tame, what would you choose?
Oh, probably one of the big cats,
Oh,
a
yeah.
cheetah or a tiger or one of those.
Yeah, I feel you with that one. Okay, what's the most unusual job you can imagine yourself doing just for a day to experience?
Oh, just for a day? Maybe I would be a scuba diver instructor.
Good one. Never scuba dived before, have you?
I have, yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, if you were to write an autobiography today, what would the title be?
Island Girl.
Island Girl. Beach vacation or mountain retreat?
Beach.
Okay, we have two left. If you could time travel to any era for a day, what fashion trend would you want to rock?
Strangely enough, Victorian, even though I know it's very, it'd be very uncomfortable, but I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, we did something at school one day that we went to a Victorian, well, a fake Victorian village, and we had to dress up. We probably didn't have the corsets as tight
That's the one. I'm not sure. But I'd be curious about it to see how does that really all work?
Yeah. Interesting. And last one, Anita, what do you want people to take away from this conversation that we're about to have?
What I want them to take away is that if they happen to be struggling with eating and food and body image, that it's absolutely possible to be completely free from the struggle.
Love that takeaway message already. So let's dive into the main part of the episode then, Anita. And I would just personally like to know, and I'm sure my listeners would too, what's your experience? How have you become from where you were to where you are today? I would love to know a bit about you and your experience, your journey.
Well, it's been a long one. I, as I said before, I started out, I'm from the island of Guam, and that's a matrilineal culture. And I grew up in it with a strong family of women. So I was always interested in women's issues, and more so as I grew older. And then as a psychologist, I was working with a psychology intern who was studying the incidence of eating disorders in Hawaii. And the more we talked about it, we realized there was a really big problem. And every single time we said, oh my gosh, there's a big problem here. There should be a center for this. After about the fifth time, we looked at each other and we laughed and we said, okay, I guess we're it. And it was, this is a long time ago, mind you. This is back in 1982. So nothing was being done. There was very little research, minimal treatment. And so it was like we created a center and they came. And girls and women of all sizes, all ages, all ethnicities, all struggling with body image, eating in some way. And so that was the beginning of my becoming really interested in this field, because these women were amazing. They were some of the brightest, most intuitive, creative people I'd ever met, but they didn't see that. All they saw was their struggle. And so that was sort of the beginning of my diving in to see, okay, what is it? What's the common thread? Why? First of all, in those days, no males were showing up. And so my question was, well, why women? Why these particular girls and women? And why was the struggle around eating and food? So that's the piece I was curious about. And then I just decided to listen as carefully as I could to their stories to see if I could find out what that was. And I haven't stopped.
I listened to you in one of your podcast interviews. I can't think of the podcast host, but I've listened a few times because I kept having to pause, and I'll share with you what it was in a moment, rewind and be like, oh my God, that has just landed so deep for me. And it was when you were talking about humans, especially children, we have two innate needs, connection and authenticity to be ourselves. So would you mind, I guess, repeating, but for me and for our listeners, like what, how that plays into perhaps the development of an eating disorder and lack of self-worth and self-love?
Sure. And this comes from some of Gabor Mate's work. He's a Canadian physician, and he talks about these two very powerful drives that we're born with. And one is the drive for attachment and connection. And we have that strong drive because we're mammals, right? We don't just hatch out of an egg like a lizard or a turtle and go on our way in life. No, we have to attach to our caregivers in order to be fed and taken care of. And because we're humans, that's our entire childhood, basically. But we're also born with another equally powerful drive because we're humans. And that's the drive for authenticity, to be our authentic self, to live our destiny, to go where we're meant and go to go in life and be who we're meant to become. And what happens for all, this happens for all of us, is that these two drives come into conflict in our childhood. The drive to attach, but at the same time, there's a conflicting drive to be our authentic self. So, for example, what this might look like is little kid wants a cookie. And mommy says, no, you can't have a cookie. We're having dinner in an hour. And little kid says, I want a cookie. I want a cookie. And mommy says, if you don't stop, you're not getting any cookies at all. So little kid goes, okay, I don't want a cookie. Now, right there, this seems like this is no big deal. But what happens for some people more than others is that whenever there's a conflict between attachment, being the way mommy wants us to be for, in this example, and expressing our true feelings, whenever there's this conflict, attachment wins. And for a good reason, because it has to. Our survival depends on it, right? But then what happens is there becomes a pattern of this, and this pattern gets carried into adulthood when really authenticity needs to win. But the real problem with this is that whenever you are the way you think someone wants you to be, whether you try to look like or act like or think like or feel like how you imagine they want you to look and act and think, and inside you're feeling differently, it creates a kind of tension inside of yourself. And this tension can eventually become very painful. And we will grab onto anything to try to alleviate that pain. And this is the gap that disordered eating steps in, because it works in that moment, right? We use food to comfort and soothe us. And so, but then that becomes the only way we need to comfort and soothe ourselves. And then we have a problem.
Yeah, that really hit for me. The fight internally between, this was all unconscious, obviously, being my true authentic self. But if I was that, I wasn't getting my needs met and I wasn't receiving love and attention. So that's my eating disorder started, and also my mask of people being the best people pleaser in the
That's
entire
right.
world. And that's rejecting self, isn't it? And not honoring my needs.
And to make it more complicated, one of the things I discovered is those who struggle with disordered eating in some way typically are very emotionally sensitive and highly intuitive. So that means they're really good at picking up on and responding to the needs and feelings of others. And that sets the stage right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And how does, so you said using food for comfort, which I've been there, done that before. But for me, it started with restrictions. So would you say that restriction is just in the, it's just the opposite end, isn't it? It's the same thing in a different way.
Sure. It's the fear of that. So if you can imagine two tanks, and we're going to call them tank A, tank B. And tank A is the tank you fill when you need physical nourishment and you fill it with food. Tank B is the tank you fill when you need emotional or spiritual nourishment. And we fill it with things like attention, affection, appreciation, meditation, prayer, and so on. But we don't know this. We think there's just one tank. So before we know, tank A is full and overflowing, but we're still hungry. Or we don't even want to get close to tank A. This is the restriction piece because it seems like the bottomless pit, right? And so then we're just going to avoid it. And really, what has to happen is we have to learn how to tease the two tanks apart so we can distinguish between two very different kinds of hunger, physical hunger and non-physical hunger. And so you do that by learning your body signals, interoception. It's understanding the signals from inside your body. So for example, when we say my head is pounding, my heart is racing, my stomach is growling, that's interoceptive awareness. So that's the first thing someone has to learn so that you can tease these two tanks apart. But then it gets, this is where the fun begins, because this is when it gets interesting. Because what happens is you use the language of sensation. So you know when you're hungry, you know when you're full. And so then you're reaching for that pizza, for example, and you've learned to check in for your hunger signal. And there's not a hunger signal in sight. You're not hungry, but you still want to eat that pizza. Well, that means you've fallen into Alice in Wonderland's rabbit hole and you've landed smack dab in tank B. And in tank B, pizza's not pizza. food isn't food. What is it? It's a concrete symbol of another kind of hunger that you may not even know about. So that's when it gets really interesting, because actually the food itself or your pattern with food will tell you exactly what those hungers are. And that's going to point you towards the skills you need to develop.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, because I primarily work with, well, I work with all eating disorders. And I found or kind of stumbled into recovery through experiencing binge eating disorder. But what I've discovered about myself as I've gone on is my binge eating disorder was actually born from restriction. And then because I'd restricted for so long, tank B, for example, I wasn't even aware of.
Exactly.
And because I had a fear of there not being enough physically in the food because of restriction before, I was always putting into tank A, which I learned to accept, because not accepting filling tank A up made me either restrict or restrict and binge anyway. So when I brought tank B, I love your analogies that I'm using here, alongside tank A, separate but alongside, and started to look at tank B and let tank A do whatever it's going to do. Because if I tried not to fill tank A, that wasn't healthy for
make
me.
It worse. It'll just make it worse. And because if you look at patterns of eating, it's really revealing. And that's why I like to work with metaphor, because it takes you into a different part of your brain where you can see a bigger picture. So for example, if somebody restricts their food, that is not the only thing they're restricting.
No.
They're restricting their emotions. They're restricting new experiences. They're restricting intimacy. They're putting themselves on restriction if they make a mistake.
Yes.
So they're doing it with food. And that's what gets our attention, because it could be life-threatening, right? But it's this whole pattern. And why does someone restrict? Typically because things feel like too much. And so then that points you in the direction of, okay, then what are the skills a person who's feeling like life is too much or they're too much, what are the skills they need? Well, they need how to learn how to develop boundaries, for one, right? So that so things can be more contained. If somebody is binging and purging, you see this pattern everywhere in their lives of taking in, taking on too much too quickly, and got to get rid of it. So they might sign up for a whole bunch of classes, get overwhelmed, and drop out of school. Or maybe they'll fall madly in love, and as soon as there's a flaw they discover, it's over. Or maybe they'll start a whole bunch of projects and get overwhelmed and just drop them all. Or meet someone and become best friends, and at the sign of the first sign of conflict, they ghost them. So you see, it's this pattern. It gets played out in food, but it's in a lot of other areas. And if someone is binge eating or yo-yo dieting, what you see is you'll see this theme of scarcity everywhere. It's not just that there's not enough food, there's not enough coffee, there's not enough money, there's not enough time, there's not enough attention, or they feel like they're not enough. And so you start to see that, that this struggle really goes way beyond food. And if we just follow the breadcrumbs, we're going to get to the real issues and resolve those.
And I've been in all three of those. And now I've learned that about myself, and I just honor my, you know, it's a work in progress, reparenting myself, honoring my needs, setting boundaries. It's interesting. I want to bring this up because when I tend to speak from personal experience, it helps a lot of other people. So when you were sharing the restriction about perhaps feeling like you were too much and then lack of boundaries, I was told as a child, I was too much, too confident, too this, too pretty, too whatever. And then I also didn't have boundaries modeled to me. So I didn't know what to do or how to cope. So I just kept myself as small as possible, emotionally, physically, and then therefore from the food as well.
Exactly. So you can go, well, no wonder, right? No wonder you developed the eating disorder, because it was the best you could come up with at that point in time. Because when we're young, our resources are limited. We gotta work with whatever we got. And so the idea is to find out, okay, what is the job of the disordered eating so you can
Yes.
find other ways to put it out of the job.
Yeah.
And so that's why I use a lot of metaphor and story to help, because sometimes you're so locked into it, you can't, if I were to ask someone, oh, what's the job of your eating disorder? They'll look at me like, well, I don't know, because it's unconscious, right? It's not something you say, okay, now I'm going to deal with this by restricting my food. It's like, it's not like that. And so one of my favorite stories that I tell, and it's my favorite because I just hear from people all over that
I
go,
hope you're going to go into the log because I was going to ask you
right.
to share that. Yes.
Okay. Because that it really is a way of starting to understand what this is all about.
Yeah.
So I always start with our superpower, which is our imagination, right? Because some people say, well, I don't have a very good imagination. And I like to say, what do you think worry is? Worry
Oh,
is a
good
really
one.
bad use of a really good imagination, right? So we're
Yeah.
going to use imagination in service of recovery. So you imagine you're on the banks of a raging river. It's pouring down rain. You slip, you fall in, you're drowning, you're getting pulled down through the rapids, and along comes a big log, and you grab on. And the log saves your life. It keeps your head above water when surely you would have drowned. And eventually it carries you to a place in the river where the water's calm. And from there you can see the riverbank, but you can't get there because you're holding on to the log. So the irony is the very thing that just saved your life is now getting in the way of you going where you want to go in life. And to make it more complicated, there's usually someone on that riverbank yelling, let go of the log, let go of the log. And you feel like an absolute idiot because you can't let go. Well, the way I see it is letting go of that log may not be the best thing to do initially. Because what happens if you let go of that log, start to swim to shore, get halfway there, and realize, oh, shoot, I don't have the strength to make it? Well, that means you don't have the strength to make it back to the log either, and you're really sunk. So what do you do instead? Well, you let go of the log and you try floating. And when you start to sink, you grab back on. Then you let go of the log and you practice treading water. And when you get tired, you grab back on. Then you let go of the log and you swim around it once and grab back on. Twice, grab back on. 100 times, 200 times, whatever it takes for you to have the strength and confidence to make it to shore, then you let go of the log. So that's how I envision the recovery journey. Right? It's like you first have to understand that whatever it is you're doing with food has served a function,
Yes.
a very important function, and it would behoove you to find out what that function is, because that's going to point you towards whatever the skills are that you need to develop so that you can let go.
Yes, I love that analogy so much, as I'm sure many others do as well. And
Mm-hmm.
with the skills to develop to let go of that log and to swim to shore, I don't know about you, but I feel that I guess I'm trying to make it fit into this analogy. I believe that what got me into the eating disorder, not the reason why, because that's the raging storm that you fell into the river, right? The emotional trauma from childhood, supposedly. Everything that I needed within me to start the eating disorder, to start with the discipline and all of that, is everything you need to get out of the eating disorder. So we already have within us what we need to get out of it. It's just trusting and seeing that within us, isn't it?
Right. Because what happens in the beginning is you think the problem is food.
Yes.
And that's what keeps you from seeing not just what the real problem is, but then using those faculties that you already have to create something else, a different kind of relationship with food. And so I think that's often really tricky for people to start to look at it in a different way. And again, that's where I use metaphor to kind of almost like break the spell that you're under. And so going back to tank B, right? Because this is what we fall into, is that when you find yourself either wanting to eat and you're not hungry or not letting yourself eat when you are, and you know the difference because you've learned interoceptive awareness, you've learned to read those body sensations. The irony is the very foods you're struggling with is going to help you use your other faculties to find your way out. So the problem is those foods are coded, and they're coded metaphorically. So in order to do that, you have to crack the code. So for example, sweet foods, let's say sweet foods are problematic. Often sweet foods have to do with either feeling like there's not enough sweetness in your life or you're not sweet enough. Now, think of the way we use the word sweet. We might say, oh my gosh, she's so sweet, or what a sweetheart, or where's the sweet spot, or whoa, sweet. So we use that word in many ways other than just with food. And that is a key for unlocking what might be going on. Crunchy, salty foods are usually associated with unexpressed anger and frustration, like you want to bite someone's head off. Warm foods are typically connected to emotional warmth or feeling heated up. Spicy foods, and again, we're talking either a fear of or a craving for excitement, stimulation, or change. And chocolate, we know this from Valentine's Day, right? That's romance and sensuality and sexuality and love. So using those foods themselves as clues can help you see really what it is. A quick example, I had a client, she struggled with bulimia. And I asked her, I said, okay, is there any food that you wished you could eat and there would be zero consequences, no consequences whatsoever? And she said, oh yeah, that would be strawberry. No, it would be vanilla ice cream with strawberries on top. And I said, okay, imagine I've never had vanilla ice cream with strawberries on top, and you're going to tell me what's so wonderful about it. And she said, well, it's sweet, it's smooth, and it's refreshing. And when we got to talking about what was going on in her life at that time, her boyfriend had been accusing her of not being sweet enough. She just hit a rough patch with her parents and was desperately wanting things to smooth out. And she was in a dead-end job in need of a refreshing change. Here it was. This is where the work lay.
That is so interesting. And you know, it's something about chocolate. I'll share my story with this. So, and I do want to ask you about the biological aspect of recovery from a restrictive eating disorder and pleasure in a moment. But in terms of chocolate, connecting to sexuality and intimacy, I've just become aware, because I eat unrestrictedly, so I don't restrict, I don't try moderation, I just follow my cravings and listen to my body. And I've noticed, and this isn't good or bad, it's just interesting, when I'm being more intimate with my husband, when I'm getting more attention, more physical touch, more sex, I eat less chocolate.
Yes.
without me trying to eat less, without me wanting to eat less, I just notice I'm buying less bars when I'm at the stage in my cycle where I'm wanting to be touched more. So that is so interesting that you've linked chocolate to, you know, sexuality and intimacy, because I've actually experienced that for real in my life.
Right. All of us do. You know, we use food for ways other than actual physical nourishment. And I think what you mentioned about the restricting, when you start restriction, that just amplifies everything. And then things can spin out of control. But for all of us, you know, I mean, that is why we get chocolate on Valentine's Day, right? It's not an accident. There's something to that.
Yeah, for sure. So what about, as we're on the subject of pleasure, let's still dive into that. What's your take on someone who isn't hungry? And I'll give my take. My audience knows my take, but I think it's worth me reiterating it. If someone's not physically hungry, they're well nourished, and they just want to eat the chocolate or the cake or the crisps simply for pleasure, what's your take or your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happens, you see, because it's pleasure that comes from relief of some sort, of satisfying a particular need that you may not know that you have even. So that's where the food kind of steps in, because it operates unconsciously. And the idea is, if you bring it into consciousness, then you're going to have, better understanding. So I had a client, she was an emergency room physician, and she struggled with binge eating. And one day she came into my office and she was so upset. She goes, "I can't believe what I did. I'm so disgusted. I can't." And I said, "Wow, what happened?" And she said, "Well, I came home from work and I was fixing dinner for my husband, and I was making chicken tenders, and I ate them all before he even came home. I'm so disgusted. I'm so upset." And I said, "Wait a minute, let's roll the clock back and see if we can sort this down." And I said, "So you were working in the emergency room, tending to all kinds of physical and emotional traumas, right?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "About what, 10, 14 to 12 hours? And she said, "Yeah." I said, "So what do you think you were really hungry for?" Because we had worked for quite a while. And she said, "A hug." I said, "Yeah, you wanted some TLC, some tender loving care, and instead you ate the chicken tenders." Now, this is how it works. This may seem crazy, but it really, it gets encoded in there. And she laughed, just like, when you laugh, because when you laugh is when something clicks. Now, it may not, if I had been off target with that, if that wasn't it, she wouldn't have had the response, but it was. Now, she can never have chicken tenders again when she's not hungry, without asking herself, "Maybe I want a hug." If she's hungry, then chicken tenders is just chicken tenders. Food is just food. It's when you're not letting yourself eat, or you are eating and you're not hungry, that's when it becomes symbolic. And that's when you can start to see what's coded. So the pleasure is connected to that, in the sense that what she needed, what would have given her pleasure truly in that moment, would have been a hug, because it had been a rough day in the emergency room. And so just recognizing that shifts everything.
Yeah.
So, and we've been taught, many of us have been taught, that pleasure is a bad thing, and that we're selfish for wanting it and wanting to get our needs met. And that's just conditioning by other people who were conditioned, or by people who are wanting to manipulate you, or by people that don't have your best interests at heart, or by people who are simply misguided. And so, that whole relationship, especially for women, with pleasure is complicated.
Yeah, that was something I deep dived into when I was in a coaching call, and my coach asked me, "What's your relationship to pleasure in general?" And all these limiting beliefs came up. I have to earn it. I have to give something first. And so I guess for me, when I was having a long day and I'd sit down at the end of the day and I'd have a tub of ice cream or whatever it would be, and there's nothing wrong with that, because any form of restriction creates a rebellion or deeper restriction. But it's interesting to see what perhaps, as well as the tub of ice cream, maybe relaxing in the day for 10 minutes, if, like adding stuff in to support myself through my emotional need.
Exactly.
I'm curious what your take is on, so for me, for example, every night, unless I haven't got it or I don't want it, at the end of the day, and I do have my own days now, I'm meditating in the day, I love my days, I don't feel frazzled, I work with amazing clients all day. And after dinner, I'm not hungry, I'm physically nourished, and I want to eat chocolate because it tastes, I want the taste and the pleasure of the chocolate. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I always allow it. I encourage my clients to do the same. But I'm curious, if like we were working together, for example, would you dive into that, or would you only dive into that if I thought it was a problem?
Well, if you're wanting to understand it more, certainly there are physical components. For example, there's caffeine and there's sugar in chocolate, which gives us a bit of an energy boost. So sometimes if we're feeling fatigue, we might reach for something that'll give us energy. But it tends to only get out of control when that's the then when that's the only way you can get all these other things as well. If we were working together and you wanted to explore this and this felt troublesome for you, I would ask you to describe the chocolate to me, what the experience of eating the chocolate is, and then I would be listening very carefully to the words you use. I would be looking to see where there's some energy, and that would point me towards asking more questions about that.
Okay.
So yeah, you can start to unpack it.
Can we do that? By the way, to my listeners, it's never a problem for me to eat whatever chocolate I want, nor for you too. But I'm just really curious if I can learn from you in this without making chocolate eating a bad thing. It never is, in my
Yeah,
opinion.
it's
So
not.
me describing to you
Right.
what I
So I
get.
would ask you, what kind of chocolate?
Milk or dark high quality chocolate?
Okay. Milk or dark high quality chocolate. So, do you like it with anything else, or just how do you eat it?
So what I do is I have about seven different flavors of different bars, Lindt bars from milk to dark, and then I get a cup of tea and I get a bowl and I take a piece from every different flavor because I need variety. And then I sit down in front of Disney Channel or Gaia and watch something spiritual or a Disney film. And I sit with my cup of tea and I hold it here. So it's like it's warm and comforting on my chest here. And I take a piece of chocolate and no one can speak to me. So if my husband asks me a question, I just point to my mouth and I'm like, no one is interrupting this moment. And then I close my eyes and then I just have a sip of my tea and I'm just like enjoying the physical taste, the pleasure of eating the chocolate. And I do that, I guess, slowly, not slowly. I don't really pay attention intuitively till I finish the bowl and then that's it.
Okay, so if I were you, here's the question I would be looking at, and if this were troublesome and you're trying to
Yeah.
find out why do I do this, why can't I stop, right?
Yes.
Which is not what we're talking about here,
Yes.
but the things that came that there was energy around, first of all, was high quality. So I would ask myself, in what areas of my life is it essential for me that things be of the highest quality, where there would be variety, a spiritual component, and heartfelt sacred space.
Yes, to all of those things.
Right. Because now see, what's interesting is you're already doing that consciously and deliberately, which is why it's
Yes,
not a problem. Right?
exactly.
If you were
Yes.
unaware that you needed sacred space where you could have heartfelt connection and not just the same old, same old, same old, but with enough of variety and high quality experience, if you weren't aware of that, then chocolate might be a problem.
Yes,
Isn't
that is so fascinating. Thank you so much
it?
for just sharing a bit of your
Yeah.
active, therapy coaching because I love what you're about and I was so intrigued how that would work like in
Yeah.
real
It's
time.
in the language. You see, we don't realize that. If any of your listeners want, there's a PDF they can download for free. All they have to do is go to lightofthemooncafe.com/FFB for
I'll link it.
food, freedom, body, love, right? And there's a little process that they can take through themselves to see, okay, what does this food mean or what does that food mean? Because it's really kind of fun. This is the
Yeah.
fun part of the recovery process when you have these aha moments and you go, oh, wow, here it is. And it's through really playing with your food, which is probably what our mothers taught us not to do. But when you play with it, you can discover some amazing things
With
instead
lack
of
of judgment
fighting it.
and lack of judgment and just curiosity, loving
Curiosity is
curiosity.
the key.
Yes, that's so cool. So one question around biology, and then I'd like to go into some body image stuff if you're happy with that.
Sure.
So, and I'm asking this question, I guess, more so to support the listeners with where I think the majority of them might be at. When someone's recovering from, let's say, anorexia, or it doesn't have to be a label, any kind of restrictive eating disorder where there's been restriction in the past, and the body is trying to weight restore and get back to its natural set point weight, I personally, and I'd love your professional opinion, don't think it's helpful to look at tank. It is always helpful to look at tank B, but in terms of if they're eating anything and everything, and a lot of it, the extreme hunger, it's just to keep allowing, because the body's trying to meet a biological, physical need. Would you agree without looking at the, oh, what could this mean? Where it could just be like your body needs more calories.
So you're talking about when someone has been restricting
Yeah.
and yeah. So actually it can it, looking at tank B can still be helpful.
And on the
So
side.
for example, I was speaking with a patient in my residential facility, Aipono in Hawaii, and she was a young girl. She was there for severe restriction. And I asked her, I said, okay, so what food just is like, ugh, would be the worst food you could ever eat? And she said, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I can't stand them. So I said, okay, I want you to imagine. I haven't had peanut butter jelly sandwich, but I want to know what is so awful. What is it that you cannot stand about this? And she said, well, the jelly is so sickening sweet. The peanut butter is really sticky, and then it's mushed together between two pieces of bread. And then we started unpacking that, and really what she came, well, I didn't have to do much. When she heard herself talking, she knew exactly what she was talking about because her mother was cloyingly sweet, just sweet, over the top. Her father was super overprotective and stuck to her. And then she was caught between the conflict between the two.
Wow.
So you can see that it's talking to you, but
Yeah.
it's talking in code. And if you can start to listen with your inner ear, then you can start to really learn what's going on here.
That is so fascinating. I love this. Okay. Body image then. So I'm sure you support women with the fear of weight gain, which is not the entire root of eating disorder, that's childhood stuff, but it's a big part of someone being afraid to choose recovery, right? Whether it's binge eating, bulimia, anorexia, eating intuitively could make you gain weight, could make you lose weight, could make you stay the same weight. How do you support women to get over, in the nicest possible way, there's more to it than just that fear of weight gain?
Well, you have to understand, again, I think it helps where this came from. And essentially, it's in your brain. Okay, but our brain and our mind are not the same thing.
No.
For example, I could be listening to my music on my iPhone. Is my music in my iPhone?
No.
No, right? You couldn't take it apart by my music. Well, where is it? Well, we don't really know, right?
In the
Because
cloud.
we say in the cloud, we don't even know what the cloud is,
We
right?
don't.
So it's because music isn't a thing you can hold in your hand. It's a wave, right? It's a sound wave. And I need this device of my iPhone to be able to access the sound wave so I could hear it.
Yes.
So our brains are like our iPhones. They've been programmed to, and we have neural pathways for our thought waves to travel down. Okay, so it just helps to understand that because our brain gets programmed. And what we know with neuro, I'm a bit of a neuroscience geek, so bear with me, but what we know is that we are creating new neural pathways till the day we die. We used to think once our brain was formed, then that was it. But no, it keeps on developing. But we have super highways in there that were, when we were little, these pathways were created. And we know that neurons that wire together, fire together. So what happens for when we're little is because of the structure of our brain, it's not even fully, everything's not fully on board till we're in our mid-20s, right? So what happens is the way we think when we're little is different from the way we think when we're older. And the only way we can think when we're really little goes something like this. Bad things happen. I feel bad. I must be bad. Mommy and daddy got a divorce. I feel bad. It must be my fault. When we get older, we can go look back and go, oh, there's 1,001 reasons why mom and dad got a divorce, and none of them have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
Now, because we live in a fat phobic culture, and many grew up in fat phobic families, fat and bad get linked in the brain. So what happens is the way we think is bad things happen. I feel bad fat. I am bad fat, because fat and bad are linked. So what has to happen is that has to be uncoupled. So that we stop seeing fat as this bad thing. I mean, it's so essential for our brains. It's so essential, especially for women's bodies.
Yes.
I mean, the research that's coming out now is showing, I just read this a couple of weeks ago, that there are particular properties of the fat in our thighs and in our butts that are essential should we choose to have a baby for that baby's brain development.
Wow.
I mean, this is the stuff we've not been taught, because we've just been taught fat is bad, fat is bad. I mean, and so it really is a matter of really getting to understand that and basically reprogram your brain, because it's running on software that's like not useful.
Yes. And with that, I used to think fat was stored energy and was undesirable and ugly, and therefore you're going to be rejected and all the things. But as you were just saying, I didn't know that specifically about the fat in our bums and thighs. Fat is adipose tissue. It's a live organ.
It's an organ.
Yes. It's a live organ, and it does more than just store energy. If we didn't have fat as women, we couldn't have our hormones in balance.
Exactly.
It does so much for us.
And there's just so many things. It's interesting because women's bodies have not been studied that much. Mm. Not until 1999, right?
Wow.
Up until then, almost, and if you research it, almost every single study, whether it's for medicines or for procedures, has all been done on male bodies. And
Why
then they
is
just extrapolate, because the researchers, and understandably, they are trying to control as many factors as they can. Well,
right.
Women's bodies have an out of control factor with
Yes.
our menstrual cycle. So
yes.
that's like extra variables that they can't control for. So let's just do it on men, and then we'll just extrapolate to women. So that's why we know so little. But as you start to tune into your body more and more, it will reveal itself to you. A problem for older women is that we get this layer of fat around our bellies as we get older, that only now do we understand that fat is essential to process the progesterone that's not being created by your ovaries any longer.
Oh.
And yes, you could liposuction away, but look at the problems you'd be creating by doing that. So
Yeah.
Again, there's we've been skewed towards thinking and not recognizing, or even being in awe. In awe of, if you happen to have a woman's body or identify as one, be in awe of what that body can do. That really is the antidote to the pressures that are real in the culture. They are real, that you should be thin and skinny and have the body of a girl, not a woman. So that's real. But the more you start to understand what's amazing about our bodies and how they have this incredible wisdom that's greater than anything you could imagine, and you start to listen, it's pretty extraordinary what you can discover.
Wow, I feel like an affirmation or a mantra of I am in awe of my body.
Yeah,
That's
because it
beautiful.
is awesome when you think about all the stuff it does without you even having to tell it.
Yeah.
And yet, so many people sadly feel betrayed by their bodies because of this misunderstanding.
Yeah. And you can, anybody can, going circling back to what you said at the beginning, anyone can fully recover. Obviously,
Yeah.
if you have the right support and you're understanding your trauma and you're working through that, and then it's a matter of brain-based rewiring your fear of weight gain, it's completely possible. I've done it. I never thought I would ever be able to say the words out loud, I am not afraid of weight gain. And I'm not anymore.
You have literally changed your brain.
Literally.
Literally. And that's why when we have patients at Aipono in Hawaii, I say, listen, a lot of this might be feel like a bit of a nuisance at best, having to repeat certain things. But you're literally changing your brain. And when you leave, you're taking your brain with you.
Yes. Wow. Okay, Anita, before I ask how people can work with you, is there anything that I've not asked you that you would like to share?
Other than, I think it's really the message that you are living proof of, which is total complete recovery is possible. It means being your authentic self,
Yeah.
claiming the uniqueness of your being and celebrating that. That's what recovery is. And that's what someone is moving towards. We're each as unique as our thumbprint. And that's our beauty. That's where our beauty lies.
Amen to that. It's not about the food. And I used to get angry when people would say that to me, but I understand on a deep level, the food's just a symptom.
Yeah.
And
It's a
the anti.
paradox.
Yes,
It's
it is.
not, it is about the food because it's an eating disorder, but it's not about the food. And the not about the food is the bigger part.
Absolutely. And the antidote is to, it sounds so simple, and it's simple but not easy. The antidote is to just be our authentic selves in every way, unapologetically, the
Exactly.
Oh, so Anita, of course I'm going to link everything below, but how are you working with clients if they want to work with you? How is it done by you?
I have an online platform, the Light of the Moon Cafe, and I have self-study courses, but I also have interactive courses where we have women from around the world that are transforming their relationship with food. And we're doing it through storytelling, metaphor, poetry, and it's interactive. So my 8-week course, which is the New Crescent Moon, every single day there is a song, a poem, a story. I do a lot of storytelling, and we have a forum where people comment and respond to it, and I answer every single question and comment. And then we have live calls on Zoom. So it's really, there's nothing more powerful than women to coming together to heal. And so it's one of my biggest joys. So you can find that at lightofthemooncafe.com. I also have self-study courses where I don't interact, but you can just learn. Like I have one on assertiveness, which is, I think, is the essential skill for recovery. Or I have one cracking the hunger code, which is where you find the metaphors for the food that you can do just on your own. So that's one place. I have another website, dranitajohnston.com, and people can work with me individually through that, sign up through there. And then I have my treatment center in Hawaii, Aipono. So I'm all over
You
the
are, and it's so needed, and what a gift you are, Anita.
Well,
And
you too, because you are taking this and you're paying it forward. So that's so beautiful to me.
thank you. And lastly, it's a full moon in Leo today, I believe, as we record this, I think.
Oh,
Yeah,
great.
full moon in Leo. So if
Wow.
anyone, mind you, this won't be out when we're recording it, but look at the moon tonight, Anita, because unfortunately, unless it happens to be a full moon when this is released, everyone look at the moon and just see that big, bright, bold. Oh, the moon is just, I'm in awe of it. So, wanted to share
Oh,
that.
well, that's why Eating in the Light of the Moon is
The
the
book,
name of my
exactly.
book, because It this recovery journey is one of illumination and levity. So, bring some light into the recovery journey. I think that's what you're doing.
Yeah, love that. Thank you, Anita, so much for your time and your wisdom. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure, and I've learned so much from you. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Right. And listeners, I will see you next week. I love you and much love.